What are you?
I'm Batman.
Welcome, podcast listeners of Gotham, to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast. Look at the entire Batman franchise.
To the Batmobile. This could be the break we've been looking for.
Join Dark Knight Garrett Collins.
You look fine.
I didn't ask.
Boy Wonder Matthew Goudreau.
This is why Superman works alone.
And the world's greatest podcast detective, Adam Bunch.
Loose to plague us with his criminal conundrums.
As they look at most of the cinematic incarnations of Gotham's favorite vigilante crime fighter.
You must be joking.
Do I look like I'm joking?
From the Adam West, Burt Ward starring Batman 66.
Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
To Tim Burton's late 80s, early 90s take.
I believe the word you're looking for is...
All the way through Matt Reeves, Robert Pattinson starring The Batman.
2 years of nights have turned me into a nocturnal animal.
These podcasters take the Rogues Gallery journey through one of the most popular comic book franchises of all time.
This town needs an enema.
So start up your podcast mobile.
Fortune smiles, another day of wine and roses. Or in your case, beer and pizza. Ha!
And make sure your butler doesn't let your girlfriend in on the secret.
Has anybody ever told you you have a serious impulse control problem?
That the percolated media Batman retrospective begins now.
Let's kick some ice.
Batman Returns. Released June 19th, 1992. Budget on this was $80 million. Box office, $266 million. And this is once again directed by Tim Burton. For the last time, boys, we are finally here talking about Batman Returns. We built this up last week as something that Matt has seen a few times and never liked. And me and Adam were still on the fence. And here we are. Adam, sir, did you see this opening weekend?
I don't believe so. I was going back. I was trying to think of when I saw this and where. And I have no idea the first time or even the first couple times I've seen this movie. It may not have been until video. I don't remember a theater watch for this one ever, actually. I remember the marketing for the movie. I remember all of that more than I remember anything about the first time I saw it.
Yeah, the marketing was huge for this. I remember McDonald's had a huge thing going, which I got. I remember them having a Happy Meal that had Batman toys in it. I was psyched for this. I won't lie. I was all about Batman after that 89 film. Despite the problems that we talked about last week, I came out of 89 as a teenager like, wow, this is awesome. I can't wait for the next one. Oh, everybody's coming back. Can't wait. Tim Burton, he went off to do Edward Scissorhands, and then he wasn't going to do this. He wanted to stay away from doing a sequel. He never liked sequels, and they convinced him to do it. He said, if I can do it in my own vision, they'll let him do it. And, you know, no matter what you have to say about this movie, this is the most Burton fucking Batman movie you'll ever see. All right, Goudreau, you came out kind of positive last week, the most negative out of the three of us, but going into this week, you weren't really looking forward to this screening, were you?
It's going to be one of those shows. Like I said, I think this is the consummate movie of I wish I got more out of it than I did. Every time I sit down and watch Batman Returns, which is nowhere near as regular as some of the other films on this retro, I keep telling myself this is going to be the time I join the side of the majority. Because this is a movie that's got a hardcore devoted fan base. Like there is a cachet of Batman fans who think this is their favorite movie of all of them, including the Nolan movies, animation. So it's got a devoted fan base, and I piss them off every time I say I don't care for it. But full transparency, I did not watch this hardly at all when I was a child because my mom outright said I couldn't watch it because have you seen the fucking movie? This is one of those movies that it's PG-13, but only because PG-13 existed at the time. Looking back at it, it's amazing It didn't warrant an R, because 89, it was PG-13 as well, but there was moments of gruesome, borderline morbid humor, but the imagery was mostly with the Joker and not a lot of overt sexuality. So it kind of danced the PG-13 tightrope better than this one does, because holy shit, I guess this is what happens when you give a blank check to somebody with a very particular style. And Lord knows that Tim Burton has one, even though to this day, I believe this is the only sequel he has ever done to one of his own movies. They've been trying to make a Beetlejuice sequel for like 30 years. It's not happening, people.
Nope.
You just got to let it die. No pun intended. Because he didn't even do the Alice in Wonderland sequel. He passed that off to somebody else. There was probably going to be a Planet of the Apes sequel, but then the movie didn't make its returns. No pun intended. So this is a huge outlier. And speaking of outliers, oh my God, the production history of this movie is insane when you talk about all the stuff it went through. And to be perfectly honest, a lot of that stuff does shine through on the screen.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that I'm actually going to save for as we get into the film, because this thing, it is one of those movies that the more you look at it, the more it's like you see exactly what happened with it. A couple things, you know, it starts with the script, right? They had a script. Sam Hamm came up with a draft. It was a continuation of last week's film, continuing that story. And Burton, of course, didn't like that. So what did Burton do? He goes and he hires the writer of Heathers to come do a complete rewrite of that script. And let me tell you, the dark humor of Daniel Waters shines through in this hardcore.
Speaking of that Hamm script, let me say that it's available online. You can read it.
Yeah, I read it.
What's interesting is that really the only thing of note that carried over was Penguin and Catwoman. I'm pretty sure that was a mandate from the studio that they wanted to use these two characters, because as we talked about from the 60s show, they were next in line in a logical sense. But the Penguin in Sam Hamm's script was kind of its own thing, much like this take on the Penguin, where he was not named Oswald Cobblepot. He had two henchmen named Frickin' Frack. Which is, you know, that's cute. But the plot was basically Penguin and Catwoman going on a treasure hunt to collect these raven busts that, if you put them together, reveals where all this treasure was buried. And the big twist is that it's buried under the Batcave. So that is definitely not the movie we got. And I can also understand why Burton did not like that script. Because unlike the 89 movie, I think the original Sam Hamm script was a lot better than what they shot. This, if they had shot what Sam Hamm exclusively wrote, I don't think it would have turned out well either.
Let's talk about what they did come up with, because when I saw this originally, I did go opening day to this. I remember so well a gentleman that me and Adam used to hang out with growing up, Mr. Omar Smith. Me and him went opening weekend, opening day we went, and this is one of the only movies that after it ended, I just sat there and we just looked at the screen. We're like, what the hell did we just watch? Like, it was just,
what the hell was that?
I'm telling you, man, it was so unreal, the feelings I had coming out of that movie originally. And we'll talk about if my feelings have warmed on it since, but this is one of those movies that, you're absolutely right, Matt, that it has a hardcore following. I have never been fully on board with that following, but the more the years go by, I kind of get another glimpse at it, and I think, maybe it's better than I originally thought. We'll see what I feel after these last two viewings, because I did watch it twice for this particular podcast. And with that, let's go ahead and just jump into this, because, again, lots of behind the scenes that we're going to get into as we get into the film. So we start off with the idea that the Penguin is parented by Pee Wee Herman and Simone from Pee Wee's Big Adventure. In one of the best filmed inside jokes I've ever seen. And by the way, this opening, it was originally going to have Burgess Meredith be the dad. They had to can that because he was not feeling well. He was pretty ill at that time. So they get the guy who they caught jerking off in a theater 6 months before.
Now, I will say,
fresh off with the context of this movie. If that happened in this movie, it would not be the most overly sexual thing in this entire.
And I remember giggles happening when he originally appeared on screen. People in the theater were laughing. They're like, oh, it's the guy who was jerking off in theaters. Adam, what were you
saying? I don't think you've seen it or at least seen much of it, but in Gotham, Paul Reubens actually shows up in, I want to say, season two, putting himself out there as Penguin's father. So they actually bring him back for that as a nice little homage to this.
And we're seeing the Penguin in a cage eat a cat, and in the first 3 minutes, McDonald's is already thinking, what the fuck did we get ourselves into?
Not just McDonald's. I'm sure somewhere in a movie theater, there was someone underneath a hat, and it was Alf going, that motherfucker stole my... stole my catchphrase of eating cats.
Hey, Willie.
You said we were going to get walking. You didn't say we'd be getting Alf impressions in this podcast. Okay. We're seeing the parents just throw the penguin into the sewer, and Burton really lingers on him floating away as the opening credits just move over. And right away, Burton is establishing that this is the character we are supposed to feel
did
for.
Did you?
This is Sophie's Choice starring Danny DeVito is what we got here.
For this one, this is a movie I've seen a ridiculous amount of times, and I finally got around to listening to, and I did the director's commentary on it. It's amazing how flat Tim Burton can be talking about his own movie. But have you heard why he set up the intro this way and why we spend so long looking at the baby floating down? He loves Pirates of the Caribbean at Disney, the ride.
Oh,
so that
wow.
When it's about to go down and then it drops and it goes into the sewers, he's recreating Pirates of the Caribbean on film for the opening to this movie because he loves that ride. I found that fascinating that 30 years later,
that's
I had
crazy.
Never heard that before. Yeah. And I wouldn't believe it if I didn't hear it coming out of his own mouth.
And you know what? Now that you say it, I can definitely see it because that's exactly what they show. It looks exactly from that ride. Wow, that's bad.
Now that you say that, Matt? I wonder how pissed off he was that he didn't get the Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, right? Now, we also get Danny Elfman's new theme. Now, I love the music from last week, at least the orchestral part of it, not the Prince part, as we talked about. I felt there were some truly heroic themes done, and some of those themes are so iconic. With this score, Elfman is actually being more himself. There are no heroic themes going on here. He brings it back a little bit here and there, but this is more than Danny Elfman we've become accustomed to hearing over the years. This is more of the crazy theme parks gone mad feel that most of his scores have. Matt, you being the big Danny Elfman fan, did you find that to be fact?
I actually like his compositions a lot. I like how every character has a theme. You know, the big three each have their own orchestral piece. And there's moments where he'll put them together and kind of synchronize them when a couple of them are on screen. So I like a lot of his choices. I do miss the 89 introductory fanfare because I'm going to say it, as much as I don't like the credits for 89, boy, do these drag like crazy. You know how it's a Moses parallel? It feels like it was that way because it feels like you're in here for 33 years.
It is an exodus to get through this opening part through the credits.
Yeah, it is. I wanted to part the Red Sea to get to my television and click fast forward.
Well, I mean, he's establishing the tragedy of it, you know? There's no other way to put it. Like, this is the character we're supposed to fucking care for. Screw the fact that the movie's named after Batman, that we could care less about him as far as Burton's concerned. This character is the one we're supposed to feel tragedy for. And the music across the board is much more Burton. We don't have Prince this time. We have Susie and the Banshees, a group that, by the way, I used to love as a teenager. This is all Burton all the time.
And there's always the joke about how much screen time Batman has in this movie, so I looked it up. Of the 10 movies, not including The Batman, because that hasn't been compiled yet, this has the least amount of Batman screen time by 30 seconds at 31:15. So this is officially the movie where Batman has the least amount of screen time, and the movie should have been called Batman Returns Occasionally to His Own Movie.
Yeah. By the way, he's top billed this time, too. At least last week, I could have understood him being top billed, except he had somebody being paid a gazillion dollars. This time, no, he is top billed, but he gets less screen time. What's the one that beat it by 30 seconds, by the way? Which one was higher?
Batman and Robin is second for the month.
Oh, okay.
And 89 is third. In 89, he's in at 32:30, so only about a minute more than he is in this one. Speaking of top billing, this is fascinating. Danny DeVito is best friends with Jack Nicholson. How was he not able to construct a similar deal compared
to Danny DeVito?
Yeah. We're not talking one of the most bankable actors from his generation. I mean, Danny DeVito was a guy who, I remember him in Taxi. He had a little bit of a career there, Twins, but he was more of a producer type than he was actual bankable star.
Well, he already directed War of the Roses and Throw 'Em Up from the Train by this point.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. But those aren't bankable movies. Like, those aren't movies that actually get some. Oh, if Danny DeVito did this, it must be good. People don't really think that. But you're right. I mean, look, who knows? I do know Jack Nicholson did convince him to do it. He did say, dude, you're going to make a shit ton of money if you do it. Yep. But Adam, go
ahead. That's exactly what I was going to say, is that their friendship is what Jack going, oh, I made so much money. You got to do this role. I mean, it's, you know, you're my number one guy. You know, he convinced him to take the role. Though, at that point, I think when we all knew, you know, learned that Danny DeVito was going to be Penguin, it was like, well, yeah, duh, of course. We're going to talk in a little bit about a different role and who originally got that role and who wanted that role, but there's no way I could see anybody else for this version of Penguin except Danny DeVito at that time. Like, there's nobody else that I could even fathom taking it over.
So we're seeing a Gotham Christmas celebration going on. We have a different set designer this time, as the previous one had killed himself before this one started production. And is it just me, or does Gotham not seem as wide in scope as it was last week? Like, we get a couple establishing shots here in the beginning, but really, it doesn't seem as big as it was. Like, we're not getting a real big scope of this. Am I the only one seeing this?
I disagree. And I can't believe we're going to argue about this movie, because you probably like it more than I do. But I do find there is a lot more consistency in the set design this time around. Everything has this Art Deco look to it. Everything's more consistent, but there is still the problem where the crowd shots don't feel especially big. It still feels like 50 people live in Gotham City. Bo Welch did the set on this, who's actually become a very prominent production designer from here on out. Like, he did Men in Black, which has some really great production design. He had done Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands, so they knew he knew he could work with them. And sadly, his career almost got steamrolled because he directed the Cat in the Hat movie. But I like a lot of his work in this movie, especially the – I love that giant cat head that's on top of Stretz.
Yeah, I like
and
that.
And I like the big statue where the Christmas tree is. Everything has kind of Grand and all look to it that I appreciate a lot.
Also the husband of Catherine O'Hara, by the way. Who actually had a part in this, but they cut her out. Adam, how do you feel about the set design this time?
I'm impressed by the scope of what they're able to fit on a soundstage. The tree lighting and everything we get here at the opening, that it's all an interior, I think is pretty impressive. Yeah, I don't have the same issue either. I'm going to be on Matt's side here, that it does feel grander in scope. As Matt said, we have the same 4 dozen people that live in Gotham City, but I do feel like it's more of a city this time. We get some issues probably starting about halfway through the movie, but at least here it feels like an actual city, a little wider, a little bigger, but it gets compromised, I think, later on in the film.
So we're seeing this through Penguin's POV from inside the sewers as Alfred walks by with Christmas gifts and completely lambasts the newspaper guy for no fucking reason whatsoever.
To quote we're also joke, he was just having one really bad day. I wonder if he was walking home and was like, is this the day I finally snap and just tell Bruce Wayne to go fuck himself?
I'm writing it down as an elevator pitch. Hang on, I got an idea for an Alfred story.
We're also taken into a meeting taking place during the celebration with Max Schreck, played by Christopher Walken. Now, this is the second time the three of us have reviewed Walken as a villain. I wasn't a big fan of him in that Bond picture that we did, and I'm not a fan of him here either. Even with that huge Nosferatu-style hairdo, I do not like him. What about you guys?
Same character, right? He's pretty much playing it the exact same way. After the issues that Tim Burton had last week with Jack Palance, I'm surprised that he would get another actor who's known for that kind of, you know, stuck in their ways kind of thing. He's distracting for me.
Full disclosure here, he didn't want him. He said in the press materials leading up to this that, as he put it, Walken scared the hell out of him. Now, he eventually, I guess he warmed up to him because he eventually directed him again in Sleepy Hollow. But I do not like him as a villain. I know they wanted to do Two-Face for this, but for some reason, Burton put the kibosh on that, and we're not going to see Harvey Dent, Billy Dee Williams in this. Instead, we're seeing this guy. And I'm not sure if a big tycoon is a good enough villain for me. Matt, what about you?
So not only do we have, much like Max Zorin, two characters named Max, both have absurd haircuts, and this is the second time David Bowie was offered a role that went to Christopher Walken.
He was offered this,
but he chose to do Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me instead.
Oh, interesting.
I think Bowie would have fit in this world in a way that Christopher Walken does not. This character is only interesting because of what Walken brings to it. It's a very strange thing because the animated series, which was starting around this time, did do a lot of evil corporate businessmen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was John Daggett. There was Rupert Thorne was a mobster to a point, but he was really kind of like a black market businessman. That's kind of what Max Schreck is.
That's who this feels like, yeah.
Yeah, it's cute name recognition for hardcore movie fans, but there's a big issue with this character in particular, and it's twofold. One, because it's obvious that Harvey Dent was going to be some connected tissue to this piece because he was going to get scarred with the taser at the end, apparently. And the second one is somewhere along the line, it was going to be revealed that he was the Penguin's brother. And if that was true, this movie makes a lot more sense. And thematically, it makes a lot more of a point about the, you got one brother who was tossed aside by society and his parents. The other one got everything he ever wanted. Both of them meet horrific deaths, which we'll talk about. But I don't think he's interesting outside of Walken's demeanor, like the freaking Santa Claus, Fred Knot. I'm just a poor schmo who got lucky. And like, it is very much Christopher Walken being Christopher Walken, but he's the only reason why this character works, outside of him wearing Beetlejuice's outfit.
Now let's talk about who else appears in this room. That casting that was almost impossible to accomplish, that of Serena Kyle, who we'll later know as Catwoman. Now, I remember stories of someone we spoke about last week, Sean Young, dressing as Catwoman and waiting at the Warner offices to talk to Tim Burton. Go research those people. It's funny to hear Burton talk about it. He was hiding under a desk until security escorted her out. That is a true story. I remember seeing her on the Joan Rivers show as Catwoman. She came out in the outfit saying, I'm going to be Catwoman, and I think I'm the best suited for this part. But the one they had in mind, and the one they had originally cast, was Annette Bening.
The one that was at fitting. The one that was getting ready to shoot in a couple weeks.
She was all slated to do it until Warren Beatty got her pregnant. And she had to back away from the project.
Warren Beatty.
I was apprehensive when I heard that, but I watched a movie of hers called The Grifters before we recorded to see what producers saw in her that made her want that made them want her in the role, and I'm convinced that she could have done it. We just never saw that side of her.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives yet another reason why Warren Beatty ruined her career, but that's a whole nother podcast. I don't know. How would you guys felt if Annette Bening was actually cast in this role?
Let me see. Annette Bening, attractive, redhead, back in the 90s. Yeah, I'm all for it. Absolutely. I think she'd have been fantastic. I think it would have taken her career in a quite different way for the last 20 years after this, definitely. But I looked up, I knew that was, and I was hoping for this to look up to see, you know, is there any shots I could find of her in the suit? Because I know they'd started already tailoring them for her, and I can't find one, unfortunately. But I do think she would have brought something really good to it. I don't know if it would be as iconic as what we get out of Pfeiffer, though. Because when it comes down to it, I don't know. She brings something absolutely perfect to her version of Catwoman.
It's one of the big what-ifs, but when you look at what we got instead, there's only so much you can complain about what-ifs, because as much as I will critique this movie and mention I don't think it works anywhere near as Burton thinks it does, Michelle Pfeiffer owns the screen every time she's on and is a good example of taking a character literally, but making it work as well as he could, because there was a female empowerment to it, because she's this docile, easily walked on secretary who gets empowered. All it takes was her literally dying. Apparently, Robert Wool claims that Pfeiffer was considered for Vicki Vale, but Michael Keaton said no because they dated at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And the laundry list of people who turned down this role or were turned down, Meryl Streep was considered too old by Tim Burton. Burton said Brooke Shields was not bankable. Nicole Kidman, Jodie Foster.
Susan Sarandon really wanted it.
Cher.
Yeah.
Cher and Bowie were in this movie. This would be one of the consummate gay movies of all time.
Madonna. They wanted Madonna. A whole laundry list of people, as you said, did turn this down.
Warren Beatty helped ruin her movie career, too.
Yeah. But we get Michelle Pfeiffer, who was cast literally weeks before they were set to start shooting, being literally vacuumed into a costume that would be the stuff of BDSM legend. And she really pulls it off, like you said, Matt. We will see this role done by Halle Berry. Yes, we are reviewing that film. Anne Hathaway, which Matt and I reviewed a few years ago. And Zoe Kravitz, which we'll eventually get to as well. Dare I say, I'm with you, Matt. I think we are seeing it done the best here. I love Pfeiffer's Catwoman. She is Catwoman in this. Like, I don't see anybody owning it the way she does. But before then, we are seeing her in the most mundane, stereotypical 90s female role, that of a secretary, a relic of the Greed is Good realm, and she's good here, too. The transformation from this meek secretary to over-sexualized feline of a woman is one of my favorite parts of the film, quite honestly. By the way, we're also seeing Leatherface as Shrek's kid.
That's right.
I
finally caught that this time.
And tell him, you also have to do a Christopher Walken impersonation.
The celebration is cut short as Penguin's men throw themselves into the city and cause havoc. I love the designs of these guys. They look like they came straight from the drawing pen of Burton himself. And, oh, by the way, there's Batman just waiting for things to happen. The bat signal appears. It is a great image. I do love the image of Keaton against the backdrop of the actual signal. And here is the $6 million man himself. Yes, he got a raise to do this. Michael Keaton returning in the bat suit, throttling bad guys, and he definitely seems more comfortable this time around. Are we with him more this time than last time, guys?
I loved him in the first one. My issue is going to be, and it's going to start right here. I mean, we're just about 15 minutes into this movie, and hey, look, there's Batman in this movie, everybody. And enjoy him when you can get him, because he's not the star and he's not the focus of it. And that's going to be one of my issues that we have going about. But I think Keaton, for the most part, is not only down to play, but down to play it better.
I think he's got better material to work with here. I like him and Selena together more than I did him and Vicki Vale, even though Alfred should say at some point, hey, this woman's clearly fucking insane. What are you doing? But also, he doesn't have that let's get nuts scene in this movie that absolutely does not work for me whatsoever. He does do something that is ridiculously absurd at the end of the movie, but that's more of a cosmetic thing than a character beat. I think he's fine, but you talk about him being more comfortable. He's certainly more comfortable with accepting bloodlust in this movie.
No kidding. Oh, just because we're going to roast somebody on fire here in this movie?
Oh, yeah. Batman is so funny in Burton's world because here he is ruining Penguin's plan, right? It's almost like in Burton's world, Batman is the villain. Because this is Penguin's plan, and here's this pesky old Batman to ruin things.
You know, one of the things I was struck by as I was listening to Burton go over this is he was not originally signed to do this. You know, he was signed just for the first one.
Mm-mm.
And it wasn't until he did Edward Scissorhands he decided, yeah, I'll go ahead and go back and do it. And Edward Scissorhands, when you think about it, it's him loving the monsters. You know, if you think about, you know, Edward is, not to mention, you look at some of the similarities between him and Penguin, it's kind of weird. But
yeah,
there's no doubt where Tim Burton's priorities lie, where the character he loves, and it is nowhere near as obvious and full-on as it is in this movie.
This is also when we get the first face-to-face between Selina and Batman, as he saves her from the bad guy. And I do like this conversation, as awkward as it is. It's the Batman, or do you prefer Batman? Your choice, of course, like... Again, Pfeiffer just enhances this role so much.
I also love having this scene. Batman doesn't even give Gordon the time of day. He's literally walking away while Gordon is trying to talk to him.
Yeah.
Like Batman's like, it's the 60s thing where, I know you were incompetent. I'm doing your job for you. Just shut up and leave me alone. I'll be back next time my light shines. Which, by the way, you'd think Bruce Wayne's mailman would have figured out that he's Batman about 5 years before the scene took place.
We cut to Max making a run for it, and he ends up in the lair, I guess, of Penguin, and here's where we get our first look at Danny DeVito as the Penguin. Now, his suit was designed by the late, great Stan Winston, and while his face looks as manic as I could imagine, I'm not sure about the obviously padded suit, but I do like DeVito in this role, no matter how sexed up he is in it. How do we like Danny DeVito as Batman? Or how do we like Danny DeVito as
Danny DeVito as Batman? I kind of want to see that movie. Let me start off with the positives. I think DeVito absolutely throws himself into this role. With the way he moves in the suit, there's that black shit that keeps coming out of his mouth. I don't know what it is. I just call it black shit in my notes. The little grunt noises he makes all the time. Like, it is very rare you see Danny DeVito this completely assimilated into a role. But the Penguin, for me, is the biggest problem with this movie. Outside of his performance, I don't think anything works. We are clearly supposed to feel sympathy for this character. Burton's writing him as this Phantom of the Opera type of character where he's shunned by society, wants to, might as well be Ariel from The Little Mermaid, I want to go up and see people. But the script keeps undermining any sympathy we're supposed to have for him throughout the entire movie, whether it's him going back and forth on his plans, which seem to change on a dime, being overly crass, and just repulsive to a fault. Like, I think this is where Burton gets too in love with the cosmetic. It doesn't think enough about the character itself. And I don't care how much sad Danny Elfman music you play in a cemetery, I can't elicit sympathy for a character who wants to murder children. Like, I just think that's that's way too far down the line for me to like this character at all.
Yeah, I'm kind of there. Occasionally, he's got a pretty good look. He gave himself over to the character completely, which is great. I wish the character wasn't something that was so off-putting every time it's on screen. And not just that it's designed to be grotesque and off-putting, but it's just, it's off-putting. It, you know, the black spittle coming out every time is, as a 43-year-old man, I'm just like, okay, fucking just why? Why? Like, that is a choice that I still see this movie for 30 years, don't understand what the hell, other than to make it clear that he's dead 2 hours from now. I don't know, weird choice. It's, you know, Matt brought it up. If he was doing these things and you kind of feel for him and then he loses at the end, you get that tragedy that you get with Phantom of the Opera, which Burton himself says that he put into this movie and really put into it later when we get to a party, that's what he was going for. So you want it, but he's undermining himself with every step of the way with what he's doing. This would be such a stronger movie if he was done a different way, because he's detracting from it every time that he's involved.
Penguin tells Shrek that he's a respected monster, and he wants Shrek to make Penguin himself a respected monster. So Penguin's trying to get a PR campaign going here. And I do like how Penguin's twirling his umbrella in Shrek's face, saying his intent isn't to hypnotize him, but just give him a splitting headache. Like, again, DeVito does go head first into this role. And you guys mentioned the spittle from later on. That was actually a DeVito idea. It was food coloring mixed with mouthwash is what he came up with for that. And pretty disgusting, actually. One thing I noticed in this scene and the previous scene with Batman is Burton seems to be just making a conscientious choice to just make a black and white film. Some of the color schemes going on here, it's almost monochromatic. I don't know. How do you guys feel about the look of this
movie? I think it's a beautifully shot movie when it comes to the photography and the sets. But you're right that it's very black or white, which Tim Burton has done a lot. He loves snow. I mean, Edward Scissorhands is all about why snow exists at the end. So between that and, you know, he'll do some stuff with it later on, and Corpse Bride kind of has a similar look. Like I said, this movie is kind of the best and worst of Tim Burton all in one.
Yeah, the look of it is fantastic. I'm really glad that when he had an opportunity to do models as opposed to matte paintings that he decided to do it. And he said he wanted to because he loves doing models, and being that he got a chance to do it, he was going to. That whole Central Park that they take over and make pretty much the zoo for the Penguin, it's a model because Tim Burton said, I'm going to do a model. And it shows, you know, it shows his love for what he wants to do does carry through. Now I kind of want to see that this is just a black and white. I want the noir version of Batman Returns, because I think it would be a pretty cool watch. I really do.
I'd love a silent version of this where it's just the orchestrations.
Yeah.
When there's an absence of dialogue, I think the movie works better, because there are some bad lines in 89, but there's also some very cringeworthy sequences of dialogue throughout this. And as much as I do like the set design, I also think that the Penguin is the worst example of taking a character literally. Tim Burton's like, I don't read comics. Character's named the Penguin. I'm literally going to make him a penguin. This decrepit swamp creature who's raised by fucking penguins. He gives him the monocle for one scene. He gives him the cigarette holder, but immediately spits it out. It's as if Burton is saying, I think this character is stupid and I can only do him my way.
Mm-hmm. I think that's him in a nutshell. I think that's exactly the attitude he took while taking this movie on. We're seeing Selena come home to a husbandless house, saying hi to her cat and feeding it, listening to messages from her mother on the machine, and looking at a hello there sign in her apartment.
That sign sticks out so much before the change.
Yes. She strikes me as the kind of person who would have that in her apartment.
Exactly. I was just about ready to say that.
It's beautiful later, but boy, that sticks out like a neon sign. I get it.
She heads back to the office, and in a chilling scene in the wake of Me Too and Harvey Weinstein, Shrek pushes her out the window. This was very uncomfortable to watch. Now, in the 3 years since the previous film, we see that they have learned to finally show someone falling a bunch of stories to their death. A little better than last time. But here's when a bunch of cats come and revive her. Was this ever a part of Catwoman?
No. Well, it will be in the Halle Berry movie.
This is not a
one-time thing, but here's the thing about Catwoman, is that for the longest time, people didn't really know what to do with her. There was a period where Frank Miller could only write her as a prostitute because he couldn't think of anything else.
That's Frank Miller with
That's
women.
Miller.
So I guess Jack Napier survived because a bunch of cats came out of nowhere and licked his body. So we're going to see the Joker later on. I appreciate that it's not explained But at the same time, it makes it even more removed from the world of the first movie. Guy falls into a vat of chemicals and gets his skin bleached and all that. Yeah, I could kind of buy that. Somebody falls 10 stories and is licked by zombie cats, apparently. You're in dangerous territory. We also have an escalation in superhero movies. This feels like jumping into a endless pond, tying cinder blocks to your feet. Like, that's how big of a quantum leap this is from the first movie.
And by the way, they're not just licking her. There's a they show a cat gnawing on her hand. So, I mean, they are going all out here. Pfeiffer did say in interviews that it was uncomfortable having the cats around, and that, yes, that was her that was laying down. In fact, wranglers were nervous about the bit of fake blood on her head because cats can actually go after stuff like
it
that.
It looks like a gunshot. Like, I don't know why there's a single, like, it looks like she got shot in the forehead. It makes no sense at all. None of this scene falls makes any sense whatsoever. But, I mean, we suddenly get into the supernatural for no good goddamn reason.
Uh-huh.
And it keeps up. Like, it doesn't just happen once. That's the amazing thing. Man, that's a weird choice.
And you guys of the Batman lore, I mean, we talked about it a couple weeks ago, how you guys both read the comics at one point or another. Are you guys going with the supernatural vibe going on here, or are you kind of tuned out of it?
I have to go with it because the movie leaves me no other option.
Yep.
It's fully embracing the weird right from the opening scene. You start a movie with a glorified abortion. That's basically what they're doing. I mean, you have a mutant baby that eats a cat. What the fuck do you have to say about, oh, this is not realistic enough? Like, this is not the Matt Reeves universe or the Chris. Like, this is the opposite of the Christopher Nolan universe. It is.
Uh-huh.
We are going to be as outlandish as possible because Burton loves freaks more than anything else. That is his go-to. That is his wheelhouse. And for better or worse, mostly the latter in my part, he's taking that blank check to the bank.
Right from where I'm recording, I actually got a print of Batman and Catwoman up on a rooftop. So the relationship between these two are important to me in comics, and Catwoman's history and who she is. It's always been something that I appreciate, I admire when it's done well. Here, fuck no, it's not done well. That said, I get over it after this. So it bugs me as it's happening. Sometimes you lick the pussycat, sometimes the pussycat licks you. But after it happens, I'm over it and I go with the movie. But if they would have changed something like this today, holy shit. I mean, you make somebody look a little bit different and you're crucified everywhere. It's clear that Burton has no idea who these characters are.
Mm-hmm.
But look, if it wasn't for Pfeiffer, it would be downhill from here. I mean, it's amazing how she saves this character by her fucking presence alone.
Yeah, I get the sense Tim Burton turned into John Peters and is like, well, Catwoman must drink milk, right? Again, he thinks so literal that I'm convinced they did Freaky Friday where he entered John Peters' warped, twisted mind and is thinking like a producer who doesn't know these characters. Batman, in particular, gives you more rein than almost any other character to do your own take. I think of the Joker as the perfect example. As long as you get some essence of the character, I'm willing to go with that. In the case of Catwoman, the antagonistic, very sexualized aspect works for me. When it comes to the Penguin, outside of the name, there's nothing here that I think makes the character as interesting as he is in the comics, because I believe you could rewrite this movie, and it was rewritten multiple times, so I'm not stepping on eggshells with that. I think you could tell a really interesting story about two children of privilege in the case of, like, comparing Bruce Wayne and Oswald Cobblepot, of the one child lost their parents tragically, one lost them because they wanted absolutely nothing to do with him. And the idea of one who was born into money versus one who had to scratch and claw their way to get it. I think there is something there, and if Burton focused on that more of really making him Bruce Wayne's dark half versus this evil swamp monster, this movie might as well be called Return of Swamp Thing Part 2, with the amount of disgusting stuff. I don't think this is a good interpretation of the Penguin, in my personal opinion. And unfortunately, it affected the animated series. As much as I love it, they never did Penguin particularly well. They got the voice right. They gave him an intellectual way of speaking, but they gave him all these ridiculous schemes. He looks like the Danny DeVito Penguin. And once again, this movie does what every version of Penguin has done since Adam West. Runs for mayor and steal the Batmobile. Both of those things happened in this movie, and they were both things Burgess Meredith did.
Yes.
And the only reason it didn't happen in Gotham is because there was no Batmobile for Oswald Cobblepot to steal. I swear to God, there was going to be an episode in season 4 when Bruce Wayne's Sweet 16 rolls around, Penguin makes an admission to go steal his sports car.
I do enjoy seeing the previous scene of her coming home reenacted as a zombie, but I'm imagining if I were a kid and I came to theaters, because when I saw this, I was 15, so I was kind of attuned a little bit. I was getting movie magazines at this time. You know, I was kind of attuned as to the behind the scenes of film around this time. I imagine if I were in 89 coming to see this, expecting a superhero film, I'd feel very, very bummed. But this bit of black humor is exactly the touch added by Daniel Waters. And you have to say this about Batman Returns. It's the most mainstream Burton as Burton can get. And the fact that he was able to get this out in the stratosphere, I give him as much credit as I give James Wan for getting Malignant out there last year. Like, it's just so off the wall, balls out crazy that I tell you, man, the fact that this was able to sell the way it did is crazy to me.
Yeah, and the only other superhero movie I think that has gotten where a director really said, I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want and nobody can stop me, is ironically, which we'll talk about later, Batman and Robin reminds me a lot of this, where it's the whole thing of they made a previously successful movie and the studio said, we're going to let you do whatever you want.
Yep, we're busy. Go ahead and go do it. Just deliver it by the date.
Because we're so used to, you know, what I call the Marvel formula now, where they let you play in the sandbox if you're Marvel, but they don't let you play with the toys that much. It's almost like they're bolted to the ground, whereas there's only so much you can do. And this came out at a time where, because there were so few superhero movies, Burton really had the ability to do whatever he wants. Nowadays, if you did something this radical, you get death threats.
This is also when the famous Catwoman suit is finally made. More on that suit here in a bit. Meanwhile, the Penguin comes from the sewers and stages a rescuing of a baby, and this is how Penguin is introduced as a freak who happens to be a good guy. By the way, is Batman even in this fucking movie?
He's at home, washing his tights.
I'm telling you, man.
31-minute moniker is absolute bullshit. I want to time because... Yep.
I'm telling you, like, man. I don't think it's right.
It feels more like 20. Yeah.
Maybe as Quain as well, since he's got some scenes as Bruce.
I think this chart is actually combined Batman and Bruce Wayne.
Gotta be.
Because looking at the numbers, it makes sense that Batman Begins has the most screen time. And by the way, that movie, 69 minutes.
Oh, yes. Here he is as Alfred is decorating the Wayne Christmas tree, seeing Penguin go on TV to ask why his parents did what they did to him. We cut to the Hall of Records, where Oswald is going through files. And, of course, all of this is a ruse, right? Like, he's not really wanting to find out what his parents are. He's just trying to make himself out to look like
a
good guy.
This is, Matt, you brought up earlier that it would make sense if Shrek and Oswald were brothers or going with what he actually does with these records, which isn't really spelled out, but he's finding the firstborn sons of Gotham. You could have something really interesting there if Max was his brother and his payback. Because at the end of this, he's going to take all the firstborn kids, taking it all the way back to frickin' Moses. You got to get really lucky playing Pogs with this movie to connect what he wants to say here.
We spend so much time on this, too. Like, this isn't just like a five-minute thing.
Yeah,
this is a big portion of
Batman
the film.
And Batman literally drives to that record building and just stares, watching him take notes. That's the most Batman.
Yeah.
That's what Batman's reduced to. He's a glorified tax accountant who just has to watch him get all this shit done. And I get the sense he's in this car. Alfred's like, maybe he's legit. Bruce Wayne during the entire movie is like, no, this guy's full of shit. I think he's got a thing against carnies. I think he's racist against carnies.
Well, after facing the Joker, wouldn't you be?
During this Joker killed his parents, I probably would be.
But Penguin, he proclaims himself a man with the name Oswald Cobblepot and that he forgives his parents.
Aww.
Anyone else expect the parents to appear later? Like, where are they?
I find them dead.
Yeah. They gotta show up as Force Ghosts.
Oh. Why bring them up again if you're not going to bring them back again?
That was my feeling exactly.
This is my favorite technical issue in this movie. One of the gravestones almost falls over when he touches it.
Yes. Wobble. He looks like a Weeble Wobble, but he gets the gravestone to Weeble Wobble.
We're also seeing a woman get mugged, and here comes Catwoman in all her clawed glory, taking the guy out with claws on the face. She says, I'm Catwoman, hear me roar. There's another meeting, this time between Wayne and Shrek. and Selena makes an appearance as they are at each other's throats, rendering them both speechless. And I love how Shrek is shocked that she is alive, and Wayne is almost slipping up, giving away that they'd met before. They are just the mumbling idiots that she was in the beginning here, right?
This is where some of the dialogue is absolutely ridiculous, where she's like, that's my name, keep using it, you have to buy me a new one. And she's like, you know, it was all a blur, and I woke up. I can't believe this movie had three writers on it. Because it is so, I don't even know what the right adjective is to describe it. Sloppy is being kind, but Walken's reaction is very smart, where he's like, oh my god, I thought I killed this woman. He is like, I instantly want to fuck you. Everyone is horny in Gotham City throughout this movie. I think Joker literally did poison the water supply, and that's why everyone's so horny.
Man, it's a weird scene. And then it ends even worse. You know, it's not, oh, we got to go get her. It's, if she's going to blackmail me, I'll drop her out of high a window. What? Yeah.
Shrek says he has a surprise for Oswald and lures him down with raw fish to a party where he continues eating the fish and biting him nose off the neighbor from the Hogan family, by the way. This nose-eating scene, my God. PG-13, really? I mean, that thing just spurts blood when he bites it. It's crazy.
Could be worse. I could have a nose squirting blood.
Unbelievable that they were able to get away.
Well, there's also the, I'd like to fill her void.
Yeah.
My flinch, liver trick.
So we're seeing buildings blow up and more chaos ensues. Oh shit, here's Batman to once again put a damper on the proceedings. Able to move much slicker this time in this bat suit, throwing a batarang that gets caught by a dog. More on that later.
That is cute. It makes me laugh, though. And this woman that has the poodle, she is such a, I mean, they're all Tim Burton characters, but she, it just looks like she belongs in every Tim Burton production.
Yeah, I'm like, I look at her, I'm like, oh, that's not Helena Bonham Carter. Why else would a character like this be in the movie if it's not Helena Bonham Carter? And then I look, it's not, it's some Swiss actress you've never heard of. Which, by the way, speaking of this scene, this is where Batman stacks up a higher body count than Dolph Lundgren's Punisher. Because you got him, he straps a bomb to some guy, smiles, and then knocks him into a pit. And there is also, in the first scene when he shows up, he lights a man on fire using exhaust from the Batmobile. This Batman gives no fucks about your health insurance or whether or not you survive. He is all about justice one way or another.
And by the way, this was 9 years before he met Helena Bonham Carter, so he wouldn't be with her for quite a while. Meanwhile, Catwoman makes her way through a department store, and this is a fun bit, her taking the heads off mannequins and jumping rope with her whip before taking out a couple rent-a-cops.
I like that jump rope. Just such a cute, a little bit of levity. It's cute. It's fun. Her here in the department store is just, I already made the perfect joke a little earlier. I won't do it again, but yeah, I'd give up one of my nine lives for her.
And this also works because Catwoman's goal never changes. She is fixated on Max Shrek first and foremost. She doesn't have the multiple plot lines that Penguin is saddled with.
Batman, meanwhile, he puts a bomb in the pants of a guy I saw arm wrestle Sylvester Stallone and over the top a few years prior. Throws him down a well before he blows up. Jesus Christ. Batman doesn't kill, huh?
Tim Burton said, sorry, what'd you say?
Exactly.
Tim Burton, what's a comic book?
Then he comes face to face with the Penguin. And this is the one scene from this movie that feels like it belongs in a superhero film. I love how Penguin's like, you don't really think you'll win, do you? As Catwoman interrupts. And this is a scene directly from the trailer. I remember this being hugely prominent. And I just love how Penguin goes, I saw her first, and runs away. Like, that's just, that I like this scene a lot, actually.
You're right that it feels like a superhero movie that was written by a six-year-old. Because what Batman come back, he's like, oh, you're not the mayor. Really, Batman? No shit. And also, if you're Bruce Wayne, why aren't you like, hey, how can I help you out? Help me help you. He makes no attempt to reason with the Penguin whatsoever, and the Penguin has no reason to blow his cover like this. Mm-mm. Like, he should be playing it totally straight. Like, oh, I'm a man about town trying to rediscover myself. The fact that he's so openly honest about what he is, A, I guess that's a commentary on politicians, and B, it makes him look like a complete moron.
Yeah, I love this shot of her when she comes out and meow. Beautiful shot. The amazing thing is with Penguin, and the amount of times that I've watched this, I can't believe it. The Penguin's running for mayor, of course, blah, blah, blah. He's running for recall mayor is what he's trying to do because it's Christmas. Mm-hmm. They literally, they bring it up, it's a few lines, but they just had an election. So they had to figure out a way, oh, well, wait, we're going to do Pinky for mayor. Oh, we're going to recall him. Which is just, like, like, he's not running for mayor. He's running to recall a mayor.
Yeah, the mayor from, Tater 88. That's the only thing I know that guy from. And he feels like he's in a different movie than everybody else, because he's playing it totally straight.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, we also haven't talked about Max Schreck's power plant idea, which is so... you can tell Tim Burton not only doesn't know anything about comics, he doesn't know anything about business. Because he's like, why would you build an energy plant that's sucking power from other people? It makes no sense. Oh, my God. The rewrites in this are so evident throughout.
Batman and Catwoman fight, with Catwoman hanging him off a building before they come face-to-face again. She punctures him with a claw before she's knocked in a truck full of kitty litter. Yes, I read that right.
Because we know, Donald Trump dump trucks of kitty litter everywhere you go, right? That's how it gets transported around.
I also hate the scene where she's like, how could you? I'm a woman. That's in Catwoman's character. This Batman would not be like, oh, I'm sorry, let me help you up. Mm-hmm. This is the Batman
I thought of that
who would
too.
Say, eat shit and hit her again. Based on what's been established beforehand.
Donald Trump, Penguin, holds another rally where he tells a woman that she's the hottest young person a role model can have.
Trying to cop a feel with the black.
Yeah, he puts the pen on cops a feel. Again, this is all stuff that I see in the theater. I'm like, what the fuck is happening here?
Well, this is a great commentary on the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. I know he wasn't in office yet, but...
he was in Arkansas, though.
Yeah, it's kind of foreshadowing. We did not talk about this yet. This movie was released in June. How did you not release this around Christmas?
Yeah, Adam, you said last week that you watch this every Christmas season.
Perf. I hope your kids aren't in the house.
Yeah.
Explain yourself, sir.
It's literally one of the day that I'm like, all right, I'm going to start pulling the decorations out of the garage and making some room and rearrange the furniture. This is always just what I put on in the background that first day that I start pulling stuff out. I found it funny that the reason Tim Burton said this is in Christmas is because in Burbank, we don't have seasons. I want to have a season. And that was the thought process behind it. Like Die Hard, it's a Christmas movie, so which, you know, I got to put one on the start. Might as well put on a Batman one.
So Penguin makes his way upstairs where Catwoman awaits him, and he utters a line that to this day just continues to stun
me. I can't believe they got away with this.
Yeah.
He sees her laying on the bed and says, she's just the pussy I've been looking for. Oh, my fucking God.
I watch movies generally with subtitles on, especially when I'm taking notes. It looks so much worse than it sounds when it's on your screen.
Oh, man. She puts a burger in her mouth, which, by the way, Pfeiffer actually did do. She said in recent interviews that the only reason I did that was because I was young and I thought I could do it. There's no way she would do it today, is what she said.
Yeah, well, Ida would have a field day.
Yeah.
Like, there's no shit. Like, borderline animal abuse, because Penguin almost stabs her cat when he pulls out the umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, he also builds umbrellas that are aerodynamic enough to hold him. And he built that in the sewer. Apparently there was, like in Michael Bay's Ninja Turtles movie, where there was a book on ninjas that they read, there must have been an engineering book in aviation in all the toxic waste in that. Very well put together Christmas stocking, I must say.
They hatch a plan to get rid of Batman. Question, guys, would these two actually work together? I'm not sure I like this pairing.
This starts a trend in superhero movies of, hey, you don't like X-Hero either? Oh, me neither. Hey, let's team up, even though our interests don't really seem to gel together. Not only in Batman, because we'll talk about that for the next two movies, but almost every other superhero property has done, like, a big villain team up. Here, it's never worked for me. I always like Catwoman being her own party. Like, she's only looking out for herself. Those tend to be the best Catwoman stories. Like, Dark Knight Rises, I have a lot of problems with that movie, as it's well documented. In the 2 hours we talked about it. But I like that you never get a sense on whose side she's really on until the very end when she does effectively do the right thing. Here, this is kind of where her motives get lost. Her Schreck roadmap takes a sharp detour for the next about 20, 25 minutes. And by the way, How did Penguin get blueprints for the Batmobile?
Stop asking logic questions, please.
Yeah, there's not a reason for either of them to really be interfering with Batman whatsoever, entangling with Batman at all. I mean, she's out to kill Shrek. Cool, she can go and do that. Penguin's got his own thing going on. If he wanted to run for mayor for Shrek, he could do that without deciding he's going to blow something up randomly for something that does nothing but hurt his plan. So if they just went around their own business on their own, Batman would be at home. And they would both succeed. So this is one of those where it's find a reason to get them together just because. Though, I guess in the end, they don't really work too well together, but it's almost a reason just to write a scene to get them in the same room.
There's that part with ointment, scented or not scented.
I got ointment.
I missed it, and I spat out my coffee this morning when I was doing the research. It caught me so off guard just how overly... Never has Oswald Cobblepot been written as a poon hound. Yep. Outside of this one movie. Because even Gotham, they made him openly gay, or pretty close, like it's never emphatically stated, but read the lines, it's there. But here, I guess being in the sewer all that time, literally raised by penguins, I guess you got to get laid somehow.
If anything, they should have had her completely flip it instead of being so mousy, didn't mean for that to be a cat joke, but let her take control of Penguin, even though we get to see that in the next coming movies, and... She totally could have sent Penguin after Batman to get him out of her way.
But without this scene, guys, we wouldn't have shadow puppets and Catwoman herself giving herself a bath.
I like that so much.
I'm just imagining Pfeiffer doing that. I'm like, God damn.
Yeah, Burton's probably tugging one out off camera.
Bruce runs into Selina while she's shopping, saying that she looks like she has the holiday blues while she's offended that Catwoman is being described as weighing 140 pounds. And this causes Bruce to invite her over for dinner. We then see Penguin enter an actress's tent, and the way he throws that batarang, I thought he split the chick in two. Yeah. We'll find out later she doesn't have a scratch on her, but the way he throws that fucking thing, my God, he hucks it at that
This camera. Is really where it becomes Harvey Weinstein, because he comes in there and he's like, I'm a talent scout.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Like, this movie's fucking prophetic for being 30 years old. It's kind of disgusting.
Absolutely. So the dinner is happening, and we have the first piece of mud slung Vicky Vale's way. As he said, he had a girlfriend, but it didn't really work out. And there is a huge, for lack of a better word, game of cat and mouse going on between these two while they try to figure out who the other is. Question, do they both know at this point, and they're just trying to get the other to admit it? Because that's how I feel.
I don't think they know, because this Bruce Wayne is so closely guarded, and she is far too unstable at this point to, I think, put the pieces together.
I don't think they are at this point. And both of them, when they start making out on the couch, have their wounds come into play here. You know, he's got the stab that he's got in the midsection, but she's also got the burn from the napalm that she's got on her arm as well. So it's kind of nice to see them both trying to hide what they've already done to each other.
This is also the second mud ball thrown at Vicky Vale, because Bruce calls Alfred earlier on, where he's like, oh, yeah? Who let Vicky Vale into the Batcave?
No, that's later.
Okay. See, this movie can interchange so much with scenes that I forget what happens first. Uh-huh.
So their uncomfortable makeout session is interrupted by a bulletin that there is now a missing girl. He tells Alfred to tell her that he's out of town, while she says, make up a dirty limerick or something. And Alfred just goes, one just sprang to mind. Penguin's men find the Batmobile and equip it with a tracer and something that they can use to control it. While he goes to the kidnap girl before fighting Catwoman again, before she drags the girl away to the top of the building, while Penguin throws an umbrella full of bats that makes her fall off the building and frames Batman for the murder. Did any of this actually go on in the comics where they frame Batman like this? Or is this just Joker plot?
I don't know about Penguin and Catwoman specifically, but yeah, Batman's been framed for murder multiple times.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it kind of comes at the territory for a guy who has a no-kill rule to be framed for murder.
In fact, I just finished reading a miniseries where he's framed for killing Henri Ducard.
By the way, where is Shrek and why is the city buying this shit?
This is the Dark Knight Rises where Gotham is full of morons that I don't believe. and they're so easily, like, as soon as they find out they're being duped later on, they turn on him. But if that never came out, speaking of prophetic, they're Trump supporters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, there you go.
Even when the truth comes out, you have to wonder, like, I'm only mad because the guy next to me is mad.
The other question I had is, mistletoe really deadly? And why is this the line that where they find out for sure who
yes,
the other
is?
I hate this
line. It is
actually
deadly.
Yes. As someone who does scouts, who sells it with scouts every year, we have to wear gloves even to prepare it. Yes.
There's a forotoxin is what's the compound inside of it that causes all the yoga blinds.
Okay.
It's not pretty if you eat mistletoe, so it's literally... That is the most accurate thing in this movie.
Batman gets away from Catwoman and flies the bats away. Penguin gets mad that Catwoman isn't acting on his advances, so he flies her away.
What was it you were saying, oh, when he flies away? I'm going to look as menacing as possible, even though I'm trying to clear myself of attempted murder charges or suspected murder. I'm going to fly with all the bats around the dead body. Batman is a freaking idiot.
He does look like a toy where you push a button and the wing pops out. When he's there.
Yes.
He looks like Buzz Lightyear.
And by the way, I think they did sell that toy.
He looks like Buzz Lightyear when he jumps off that.
Oh, my God.
It's true. He doesn't. He doesn't fly. He falls with style.
Batman then makes his way to the Batmobile. And my favorite part of this movie, as stupid as it is, might be of the Penguin riding the Batmobile that looks like one of those quarter ride machines that were located in front of Target when we were kids, Adam. Yelling that his license has expired as Batman runs cars down, not under his control. This is fun shit for me.
All right, so
I kind of like
for this. All the people who claim this movie is so dark and, you know, not for kids, this is one of the most childish things you will see in any Batman movie. I think sometimes we misconstrue how quote unquote dark this movie is in context, and shit like this is. This does not mesh with anything we have seen beforehand. Like, this to me is Adam West. This is an Adam West bullet point, basically, where someone takes over the Batmobile and they have their own little replica. I hate this so much.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I get what they're going for. I don't like the way that it's done. I don't like the way that it's staged. And I don't even like the way that it's shot where he's just bouncing up.
I love that.
I don't know. Nothing about it sits well with me. Ugh.
Somehow, through the midst of this chaos, he records the conversations going on here. More on that here in a little bit. He punches a hole in the car and pulls out the thing controlling it before making the car skinny enough to fit between two buildings and getting away. Penguin again talks in front of people, and Bruce Wayne's plan is in full swing as he plays a CD of their conversation. Yes, a CD. And yes, he does scratch the CD.
He does!
I couldn't believe that.
Wiggle, wiggle, wiggle.
And this is right after, Matt, he takes the jab that you mentioned about Vicki Vale being in the Batcave. Oh, I turn around, there she is. That was a line added by, I believe, Daniel Waters to kind of call back to that, because Daniel Waters himself was pissed.
Did you say Daniel Waters because he puts his hand into a fish tank?
Here we go. Oh, the terrible puns.
Well, Penguin has one of my favorite lines in the entire movie where he's like, he didn't even lose a limb, an eyeball, bladder control. He's like, why is there someone who always brings eggs and tomatoes to a speech?
Shrek just kind of shrugs his shoulders and leaves as Penguin is pelted with tomatoes and loses all inhibitions, blasting away with his umbrella gun before diving into the water and into his duck. Now he's proclaiming he's not a human being, but an animal. And I seriously feel this is the story Burton really wants to tell, not the one of Batman saving Gotham. He wants to tell the tale of Penguin realizing, I can't integrate, I'm just going to accept being a monster. Now there's yet another plan, this one of Penguin kidnapping all the firstborn sons and killing them, although you said, Adam, that this was kind of why he went to the Hall of Records, right?
To me, that's what I took, because if you paid attention, they were all birth certificates and stuff. To me, that's what
that's
he was
right.
looking for.
That's, okay.
That's just how I took it.
Are there too many plots going
yes.
on in this film?
I'll take stupid questions okay. for $600, Alex.
You know what they could have... You could have had Shrek, you know, decide that he's going to use him for his own purposes. And in the first time that he's brought out to public, the public is revulsed and turn on him. And you could have saved 30 fucking minutes of shit you don't need for him to go, I tried it once. I will never try it again. And cut out so much of him running for mayor and gotten here a whole lot quicker. Because as you said, this is what Burton wants. Him and his little rubber ducky, I fucking love that. Him with the Penguins?
Yes.
Fun as all hell. I don't need the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking Rubber Duck, I swear, has more screen time than Batman does. This mayoral subplot would have worked a lot better if he was running against Harvey Dent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where's Billy
Dee? Yeah, where Dent was using him as a puppet. So that Dent is not the upstanding citizen that people think he is. I think that's the part where I see Harvey Dent shine through the Max Schreck character more so than anything else. I certainly don't think Harvey Dent would have pushed Selina Kyle out of a window. I mean, maybe after a few Colt 45s, you know, who knows what could happen.
Wayne is fixing the Batmobile as Alfred brings an invitation to a party that Schreck is throwing. Susie and the Banshee starts playing as Wayne and Selina, they dance at the party. And while I hate how the revelation is made, I do love the line that Pfeiffer says right after, where she's just like, does this mean we have to start fighting now? So great. Their fighting will have to wait, though, as Penguin shows up to tell of his plan, very Bond-like. He's saying, yes, I am going to take all your firstborns. And then he threatens to take Chip, and he tells Schreck, who talks him out of it, and then he tells Schreck to get in the duck. Pretty convenient that the sewer would go through here, by the way. What do you guys feel about this scene?
I like the party, and I like Bruce and Selina together. Them dancing, the reveal of it, I actually like that part quite a bit. Her tears and her emotion on the face, I like this. But this is the Batcat moment that I actually hope for, is these two right here. So that part I like. Everything having to do with Schreck and his son, I don't give two fine fucks about. Chip is a thumb, and I don't need him anywhere in this movie.
I do appreciate that this is a superhero movie, and I use that term loosely, that's actually about secret identities and the idea that there are duality, there's two sides of every person, which makes it all the more disappointing that Harvey Dent is nowhere to be seen, because everyone in this movie has a darker half that they don't show other people. But I don't think that theme is ever brought to the forefront outside of this one revelation between the two of them. Again, there's a lot of pieces in this movie that I think would make a really good meal, but Tim Burton left the oven on too long, and it's kind of, he's letting the thing boil over to the point where it's tough to make out all the individual ingredients. And, Garrett, please stop besmirching James Bond.
Well, no, I'm not besmirching it. I'm just saying that's exactly what a Bond villain would do.
Yeah,
you know, I wasn't besmirching it. I was just pointing it out.
Balls. And also, if this was David Bowie,
okay.
If that was David Bowie, this would have been, I would have been getting Labyrinth flashbacks right here.
When you talk about the duality, I do think something was wanted to be there, because between Batman having the two sides, Catwoman, and this one being much more of a bipolar type character than we've ever gotten before, Penguin having the two sides of who he is, Harvey Dent, this is why it makes sense that he was supposed to be in this one, is you get the literalization of that type of context literally transformed by the end of this movie. And hitting that would have made this movie work. Instead, he's like, oh, I'm a kooky artist. It's an idea. Duality, monsters. They'll figure it out.
We see a monkey bring a message from Batman to Penguin. Yes, I did just say that sentence. Saying that the kids won't be attending, so we get yet another plan. Penguin sends his penguins, complete with rocket launchers and other artillery, to blow Gotham sky high.
This is where they just said, fuck it. To me,
yeah.
This movie
yeah.
is the third act of 89, if it was the entire movie.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know how anybody in good conscience greenlit this. We're going to have a character who refers to himself as the Penguin, is literally a penguin, try to commit genocide with penguins with rocket launchers. Not one executive stood up and said, I know this is a conflict movie, but that's stupid.
It makes Kevin Smith yelling about John Peters, a big giant spider, it kind of renders a little bit helpless, doesn't it?
Well, yeah,
when you talk about penguins blowing up an
yeah,
entire
city.
Yeah,
we had a giant duck. I mean, why not a giant spider?
Yeah.
It makes a little bit more sense, especially Penguin could have constructed it in the sewer because he's clearly got some expertise in how to set up mechanical devices. And
uh-huh.
Burton goes so overboard here with the speech with the spotlight and the fucking Spider-Man handwritten note that he gives him. That's a Spider-Man note. That's, I mean, you know, Tim Burton doesn't know anything about Spider-Man. He doesn't understand that bit of cruel irony. Just, oh my God, I can't believe. I wish I liked this movie. I don't get it.
I was getting some 89 flashbacks as well when I was watching this, because we talked about that third act so much last week. And I'm feeling that here. Like, there's just so much chaos going on that I don't think there's any bit of sense being made. And I think you're exactly right. I think Burton just said, fuck it, we need to end this. It's already almost 2 hours. It's time to end it. The penguins, they make their way to the streets, and Batman is making his way through the sewers in a bat boat. All
cool
right.
Toy.
Yeah, exactly. We're getting a lot of toys being sold here. We're also getting a running commentary from inside Penguin's lair, and Batman turns them around by jamming their signal. By the running commentary, I mean the woman saying, the city's within range. It's almost in range. She's there just keeping an eye on
the intercom
everything.
System down in Gotham Sewer.
Yeah.
Might as well have Ben Stein delivering these lines.
They aim their weapons Penguin's way because their signal's been jammed. Penguin gets in the duck, which somehow moves upstairs, but he's stopped in his tracks by Batman. They have sort of a fight as the Penguins point their weapons and fire away, and bats make him fall into the lair that is completely blown up. Meanwhile, Shrek gets away and runs into Catwoman as we get a complete funeral dirge for the Penguin, complete with penguins leading him to a watery grave. Boy, it's obvious to see what Burton finds to be the most tragic part of this film, isn't it? We linger on this fucking shot, too. It's not just a small shot.
I mean, who was it? Did nobody go, hey, is there a reason the production needs 8 life-size penguin outfits? Don't worry about it. Just, yeah. They're for, no, you got little penguins, right? These are for people. What the fuck is going on? Because it looks like something that you'd buy at the Halloween Superstore right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a choice.
I watched a group of life-size penguins send someone to a watery grave. Peter Freeman couldn't make sense out of this shit with March of the Penguins.
Catwoman and Batman have yet another fight, which Bruce stops by ripping his mask off, and Selina responds by ripping hers off, and Shrek responds to all this by telling Selina that she's
This is where Walken actually came to play.
I agree.
He's like, yeah. Selina Kyle, you're fired. Bruce.
A very Donald Trump
why
line.
Why are you dressed like Batman? And she's like, Batman rips his mask off, even though it's a cowl, because we've seen that whole, but he just rips it off because it's so clearly rubber, and the black eye lines are also gone completely.
Yep, there we go. We get a countdown to how many lives Selina has left, as she's shot 7 times, uses the 1 life she has left to electrocute Shrek. 9 lives?
Getting shot in the kneecap constitutes as losing a life?
I suppose so.
And she respawns immediately after each bullet.
Yeah, exactly. There's another life. Boom. A couple things about this. How do we feel about the treatment of cats' lives? And also, something Matt pointed out last time is really in full spotlight here. Burton sure loves his skeletons, doesn't he? I mean, that is a mangled corpse that we see of Shrek.
Second person to a skeleton crisp.
Yeah,
I don't know how, if that was Harvey Dent, I assume that's where he would have gotten burned.
He was supposed to, yeah.
Either that or you have him get disfigured when the giant duck explodes through the building. And I can't believe I uttered those words.
I was about to say, did you really just say that?
I get the whole Catwoman does take out Shrek, so she fulfills her mission. But everything with the penguin just takes me out of what should have been the conflict. And it's also the problem of, if you're going to create a villain that is exclusive to your form of media, you got to make him more interesting than the Max Shrek character.
We didn't see a heartfelt Merry Christmas from Bruce to Alfred as Bruce sees a black cat. And we cut to a shot filmed at literally the 9th hour, 2 weeks before the movie came out. Catwoman sees the bat signal, and we are given a glimpse into what the studio plans might have been, as she, not Batman, is the last thing we see before credits roll. More on that in a bit, but let's get our opinions on Batman Returns out there first. Unless you guys have anything to say about this final few moments.
I'm glad that it quiets down for the final minute of the movie.
There you go. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do we feel about Batman Returns? I'm pretty sure I know where Matt's going to go. I'll go with Adam first.
So do I watch this movie every year? Yes, I do. Do I sit and watch this movie every year? No, I do not. And sitting and watching it to take note for this? I'm reminded as to why I don't sit and watch this movie. Oh, man. Burton damaged this IP. He really did. And on top of it, he damaged filmmakers' control, I think, in this type of medium, playing with other people's characters. It's hard to know where to lay the fault. I mean, Tim Burton's going to be Tim Burton. I think I'd feel a little better about it if I knew that he was doing a one-for-them, one-for-me way that we get, like Chris Nolan doing. Which is one of the reasons that him and the movies of his that are only okay still tend to hold up, you know, with a good level of quality because he's putting some heart into it. I, for one, like Dark Knight Rises quite a bit, probably the most out of the three of us, since we're not going to discuss it, putting that out there. But, man, this movie's got issues from writing, from just poor decisions, and nobody at Warner Brothers at that time either having the stones to tell him no or looking at it to see what they were doing. Listen to the commentary. I'm surprised. Like, he complains so much that this is just was an uncomfortable production and uncomfortable shoot for him, that he didn't have fun. He didn't like it. I don't know what the hell his problem it was, because this is his movie from opening credit to ending credit. And the issues, I mean, they lie with him. They lie with the director. This is John Peters and Tim Burton. That's not to say it's all bad. I mean, Danny DeVito is giving his all as the Penguin. I don't like the majority of it, but there are plenty of times that I'm like, man, he's hamming it up, and I can go along with it. Pfeiffer is amazing as Catwoman, hands down. To go to something else that Tim Burton would do later, I think I see a lot of Sally from Nightmare Before Christmas in this Catwoman, just a broken woman stitching herself together. And I never got that before, and I got it this time watching her make the suit, and I found that kind of beautiful. I think Pfeiffer comes to play, and it's clear she steals the show. I mean, this is the cat, the bat, and the penguin, not the other way around. Keaton's good, but I think Keaton is a damn good Batman. I think the little bit of time that he gets, does a really good job with it. The best thing about Christopher Walken in this movie is that we get to hear Matt do a Christopher Walken impression. So thank God for that, because, whew, man. But it's, I mean, this isn't a good movie. I put it on in the background for a Christmas time thing to get it going. And that's about it. Sitting down to watch it, it doesn't hold up. It's not a good Batman movie. It's not a good superhero movie. It's not a good movie. And talking here makes it even that much more clear. I mean, even the music, the score is good, but nothing that sticks out, you know, like last time. So there's not a lot good to give it. Because I watch it frequently, I'm not going to hate on it too much because there's moments I like, but I'm going to give it a 5. 5 on 10.
5 on 10 for Mr. Bunch. Goudreau, sir, where do your loyalties lie with Batman Returns?
Oh, boy. So I did a deep dive into Tim Burton recently where I watched all 19 of his movies within the span of a year. And I didn't do it all in one shot, everybody, I assure you. I noticed that my least favorite Tim Burton movies are the ones where he takes an established IP and puts his spin on it. Because I think his worst movies would be Planet of the Apes, Alice in Wonderland, Willy Wonka, or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Those are all movies where they just said, hey, can you Burtonize this, quote unquote, regardless of if he fits the property or not. And unfortunately, I feel like Batman Returns falls into that same ilk where he definitely brought his own personal flourishes to the property, but it does hinder us to the source material. 89, there's some Burton flourishes, but for the most part, it does feel like he's predominantly held at bay for most of it. Here, it's Burton unhinged, for better or worse, and I do think it's more of the worst, because the way that this plot, quote-unquote, goes back and forth, it's very lackadaisical with the logic and how it goes back and forth between the plot machinations themselves and what Burton's trying to say thematically. But this is a movie that's really at war with itself, especially with the Penguin. And when your main villain is both unsympathetic and rather uninteresting outside of the superficial and the performance, everything that's on the page is not what I'd hold up to snuff. It is, with that said, though, a very beautiful movie from a photography standpoint, from a costuming, the art direction. I think all that is, it's more confidently directed than 89, but it's held together by, much like Catwoman, I feel like this script is stitched together and barely holding this movie into the watchability territory. So I'm not going to go as high as Adam, but I also can't bring myself to say that this movie is one of the worst things Tim Burton's done. I'd say it's in his bottom 5, but like I said, it's sort of similar ilk as the ones I mentioned earlier. So my score is a 4 on 10, and I'm gonna stick with that.
I love this movie for one reason. And one reason only. You'll never see another one like it. Meaning you'll never see McDonald's put their entire market share into a property, only have to have them collectively say, oh shit, and pull the merchandise from their brand. What Burton was able to do here as far as telling his own story within an established property astounds me. That doesn't make it a great movie, though. And this is far, far from a great movie. But as the years have gone on, I've counted it closer to a good movie than I originally gave it credit for. Don't get me wrong, the end plots are a complete fucking mess. This movie is a narrative disaster. But you guys have both said, it is a beautiful film to look at, and you can't take your eyes off it, and Pfeiffer is giving her all. DeVito's giving his all in a role that I'm not sure was really written that well. I mean, there's just nothing about it that's consistent except that he's just consistently disgusting. Keaton's here to collect a paycheck. I think he's fine, but he's just not in it enough for me. This is a movie that is a narrative mess. At the same time, I can't take my eyes off it. So I want to go a little more generous than both of you. I want to go 6, but that's being very generous to a movie that when I saw it in 1992 in theaters, I just sat in theaters with the credits rolling, and me and my friend just looked at each other like, what the hell did we just see? I'm not doing that much anymore because we've seen Burton be totally Burton at this point, but it's got to be said that after this, Burton kind of took a downturn. He did make Ed Wood a couple years later. It was his next film. But after that, I'm not sure. Mars Attacks was kind of a flop. He did come back with Sleepy Hollow, but we'll never see Tim Burton be this popular again. So, yeah, 6/10 from me. Matt, how did the comic book treat this? Did Batman 89 continue with this story, too?
Yes.
Was Catwoman in that?
Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman is in the Batman 89 comic book. But so the big thing is that the story takes place right after Batman Returns. So there's a gang war between people dressed like Batman and people dressed like the Joker. Harvey Dent's going after Batman because he thinks, you know, he holds him responsible for creating all this. Dent is engaged to Barbara Gordon in that continuity. Oh, wow. There's another masked vigilante who, by the way, turns out to be Robin, who was apparently going to be Marlon Wayans.
Yep. He signed in, got paid for that.
Yeah, like, it was a done deal, but the comic, Robin is his name's Drake Winston, so they didn't give him sort of Jack Napier, where they gave him an alias that he's never really had before. He's working as like a mechanic. He takes a nickname Robin because they claimed he was robbing the store, which is about the level of writing in this movie, so I guess it's consistent with that. Yeah, there's some cringeworthy stuff, but the way Robin is integrated to Keaton's Batman, it does make sense. It makes sense how Harvey Dent gets burned by battery acid in a big explosion. Catwoman is her own party, because she's kind of going after both Dent and Barbara Gordon to a certain extent. And it's worth reading. If you're a fan of the Burton universe, it's going to give you everything you want, because it's one of the Burton's third movie is one of the big like what ifs for a lot of people. So I think it'll give you your fix.
You know, you mentioned it last podcast, and I've been meaning to check out that book. I want to go pick it up. I think that Batman 89 comic, for anybody who loves this Burton universe, and like you said, Matt, there are people who do love this universe, should go check it out. And I'm one of those people who, maybe it's more of a nostalgic thing for me, because 89 I hold so dear to my heart. I think I will go ahead and check that out. This sounds very interesting. But that does it for Batman Returns. Before we get back into the Batman cinematic universe, boys, we do have a movie to cover next week as well. We have to cover Batman Mask of the Phantasm, because apparently that was released theatrically.
It was Christmas Day, I think.
I don't remember, but I am a completist, and I think if I don't do that, I'll probably get thrown into some battery acid myself. So,
including by
we're going to go ahead and cover
including
that.
Including by your two co-hosts.
Yeah, Batman, Mask of the Phantasm, based off the animated series. I don't have much memory of this. In fact, I've probably only seen it once in my life, I believe. What do you guys remember about Mask of the Phantasm?
I know how well reviled it is. I mean, that it was, I mean, theatrical release, the cast, the story. It was a character with Phantasm that has never shown up in comics until very recently. That character was kept solely into that movie. Original story, Bruce Timm and Paul Dini. And yeah, if you love Batman the Animated Series, you probably saw it. If not, you should, in my opinion, absolutely go see it and form some opinions about it. I can't wait to discuss it.
The animated series is very much my Batman, as far as the one that influenced me the most. It was on when I was a kid. It was on syndication. It was still running while the movies were going on. So I hold that continuity has a very special place in my heart. And if you like my Christopher Walken impression, wait till you hear my Joker Mark Hamill impression, which I have done numerous times on the Binge Show. And I have been told by close people, including my own husband, hey, you're too good at that. Stop doing it because you're scared.
All right. Something to look forward to next week. Boys, it's been so great getting back into the flow of things with you guys, and we are going to continue with Batman, and Matt and I have also been recording Leo and Scorsese collaborations. That's going to be released as well. So we have a lot of stuff coming up, and guys, I appreciate you coming on this journey with me as we launch and put a new stamp on the internet between the three of us, and this has been a really fun way to launch that. So thank you, boys. I appreciate you being here with me, and until next week when we discuss Batman Mask of the Phantasm, remember, guys, you flush it, I podcast it. Thank you.
Your entrance was good, his was better.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast.
I read your work. Insightful. Naive, but insightful.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Ooh. Talk about your cold shoulder.
Just a note, the three Chris Nolan films are not going to be part of this retrospective as they were covered by Matt and Garrett on the binge movie Aftertaste just a few years ago.
Never rub another man's rhubarb.
To hear those takes, please head over to www.bingemedia.net.
Okay, go ahead. Intimidate me. Bully me if it makes you feel big. I mean, it's not like you can just kill me.
Actually, it's a lot like that.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Tonight's forecast, a freeze is coming.
Voice narration by Adam.
I hate when people talk during the movie.
Edited by Garrett.
That miserable waddling mountebank of a bird, he couldn't finish a bag of popcorn.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
So many people to kill, so little time.
Bob, done.
That, if you put them together, reveals where all this treasure was buried. Excuse me.
Bob, done.
There is a lot more consistency in the set design this time around. Excuse me, everything has this Art Deco look to it, and there's not that contrast I had with the daytime versus nighttime sequences. Oh my god, this movie's gonna kill me. by the way, everyone, if you like fruity beers, Purple Haze is one I highly recommend. It's probably what's got me through this movie. But
Bob, done.
I don't know. She brings something absolutely perfect to her version of Catwoman.
Saw what you did there. Nice.
Thank you.
I was gonna let it slide, but I'm like, no, I can't. Not with my track record. So.
Bob, done.
So you want it, but he's undermining himself with every step of the way with what he's doing. And I just, I can't get him. This would be such a stronger movie if he was done a different way, because he's detracting from it every time that he's involved.
Can you say he's undermining himself again since Jen sneezed in the background?
Bless you.
He says bless you.
That takes a swear.
Go, can you say that again so that I can get an unsneezed take?
He's undermining himself just every step of the way.
Bob, gun.
So it bugs me as it's happening. Sometimes you lick the pussycat, sometimes the pussycat licks you. but after, hey, I'm less crass than they, than Oswald a little bit.
Bob, gun.
And this came out at a time where, because there were so few superhero movies, Burton really had the ability to do whatever he wants. Nowadays, if you did something this radical, you get death threats.
In fact, someone just came out in the press and said that they weren't going to do a superhero film because of the way fans react to him or something like that. I don't remember exactly who that was, but I thought I saw something on that this week.
The director of Shazam, they asked him if he'd do a Superman movie.
And oh, yeah.
Like, no, those people are crazy.
Yeah. There you go.
Bob, gun.
She says, I'm Catwoman, hear me roar. Wow, big introduction.
That's the best you could come up with?
That's what she says. What am I supposed to say? I don't have a Michelle Pfeiffer impression, I'm sorry.
I don't know. Can you rock that outfit?
No, sir. Maybe you'll see it when you come to... No, never mind. There's another meeting.
Bob, gun.
Like Die Hard, it's a Christmas movie, so which, you know, I got to put one on the start. Might as well put on a Batman one.
I'm so happy Iron Man 3 exists now because we have a good Christmas movie that's also about the superhero.
Really? Which one
Save
is that?
It. Save it. Save that battle royal, boys.
Bob, gun.
So their uncomfortable makeout session is interrupted by a bulletin that there is now a missing girl, and Bruce tells Alfred to tell her that he's out of town as she has to get ready. He tells Alfred to tell her that he's out of town.
Bob, gun.
Goudreau, sir, where do your loyalties lie with Batman Returns?
Oh my, that was unintentional walking right there. In that manner, but. Oh, boy.
Bob, gun.